I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today with the only humanist college chaplain in the country, Greg Epstein of Harvard, is looking to build a gathering place for atheists and agnostics. Hey, wait a minute. Doesn't that sound like a church? But first. Thousands of protesters from across the country have gathered in the small town of Jena, Louisiana, in support of the so-called Jena Six, young blacks who were initially charged with attempted murder in the beating of a white student after nooses were hung from a tree and the white students who put them there were only suspended and not charged at all. The Reverend Al Sharpton says today's event could be the beginning of the 21st century's civil rights movement. The district attorney prosecuting the case broke a long silence yesterday to say the case is not and never has been about race. Well, joining us on the line, Cynthia Jardin, editorial page editor of the Alexandria Town Talk, the local daily paper in Jena. Cynthia, we were scheduled at this time to talk to a reporter at the protest, but the cell phone service has been overwhelmed. Is that your experience?
Oh, yes. There's only about 3,500 people in Jena, and it's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and now it's just filled. We're seeing pictures on CNN. The streets are filled
right.
with people and the buses. Well, let's remind ourselves of the story. It began at the beginning of the school year last year when black students wanted to sit under a tree. It's been reported that they call that tree the white tree. After that incident of black students wanting to sit there, nooses were hung from the tree. What happened to the students who did that?
I believe they were suspended from school, though they've never said how long they were suspended for.
Well, we understand there were various schoolyard skirmishes after that, and then the fight in which young blacks attacked a white young man. What charges and jail time did they initially face, and where do the charges stand now?
They initially faced attempted murder charges and conspiracy to commit attempted murder, and I believe at least five, if not all, of the charges have been reduced to second-degree aggravated battery and attempt and conspiracy to commit the same.
We understand there's been only one trial so far of Michael Bell. What happened with that trial?
He was convicted of second-degree aggravated battery and conspiracy. Since then, it's been overturned. The conviction's been overturned.
So where is he now?
He's still in jail. The prosecutor is looking at whether or not he's going to retry him, although I believe the Court of Appeals said it should be sent back to juvenile court. So.
Well, we understand the story really took off on the Internet and on radio over the past several weeks. Pop star David Bowie contributed $10,000 to a defense fund for the Jena Six. Your editorial board wrote an editorial today and in fact said that, you know, this is a promise of being a good day. What do you mean?
Right. Well, that was kind of my sense all along, is that this is the First Amendment in action. This is our chance. Actually, the country, the world will have its eye on Jena, Louisiana, and we can show that our Constitution, our democracy, is alive and it works.
Well, and you say that others are viewing this case just as a race case because of the different punishment meted out to the white students as opposed to the black students. But you also say there's a fair amount of people hoping that it's going to be, you know, a story of justice being heard. The district attorney spoke to reporters for the first time yesterday. What did he have to say?
He asked everybody not to forget the victim and that it was never a case of, it was never about race. That's, of course, you know, going to be debated by many, all those people in Jena today, I guess.
Is there thinking that this was, you know, could just have been a schoolyard fight that got out of hand?
It's hard to,
right,
to call it that simply because six guys jumped on one guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, a schoolyard fight is a couple of guys going at it.
The district attorney also said yesterday that he couldn't find a state law under which he could charge the white students who were hanging the noose. He found
right.
it a reprehensible act, but there was no state law. Is it possible that that might change now as well?
I don't know. The FBI came in and they looked at it, and it's, you know, hanging the nooses doesn't even qualify as a hate crime.
Cynthia Jardin, editorial page editor of the Alexandria Town Talk. That's the local daily newspaper in Gina, Louisiana. One billion people in the world don't believe in God, any God. That's according to the World Almanac. These non-believers sometimes refer to themselves as atheists, freethinkers, humanists. Well, Greg Epstein is spreading the word about what he calls the new humanism. As humanist chaplain at Harvard University, he hopes to build a humanist house, sort of a church for people who don't believe in God. His views have caused a bit of a stir in the atheist community, people who say a formal church is exactly why they left a church. We want to talk about that and much more with Greg, who was featured in the Boston Globe magazine recently. And he joins us in the studio now. Welcome.
Hi.
Let's do some definitions first.
Sure.
We know atheists don't believe that God exists. Agnostics don't deny that God might exist. They just don't think it can be proven. Humanists, though, we thought by definition meant a belief in the welfare of humans. So can't humanists believe in God?
Humanists believe that there is one world and only one world, the natural world, and we are focused on being as good as we can, on living as good lives as we possibly can live here in this world. Humanist with a capital H, if you will, has come to mean a progressive life stance that, without supernaturalism, affirms our ability and our responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment, aspiring to the greater good of humanity.
Let me ask you about that, the ethical lives part, because as you well know, atheists, humanists, capital H, are accused of being immoral. You know, where would you say you get your values and your ethics from, if not the Ten Commandments, for instance, as someone might say?
Sure. It's a real misnomer, the notion that you can't be good without God. It comes from the fact that obviously there's a profoundly religious ethos that has existed in American society for quite some time now. But the idea of being good without God is an idea that has been developing more and more as modern times have gone along. And really, it comes from the fact that we are social animals and we need each other in order to live a good and decent life.
And I want to jump in and say that you are in a growing number of people. A Pew Research Center for the People and Press survey found that 20% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 25 say they have no religious affiliation or consider themselves atheist or agnostic. Mm-hmm. That number's doubled in the past 20 years. We're reading in the Boston Globe account that in other countries, the belief in God has dropped. In Sweden, 85% of the population says they don't believe in God. Japan, 65% now non-believers. Why do you think that's happening? Why do you think the number's rising?
First of all, we're learning more and more about the world that we live in. And what we're learning is that the world was created by natural processes, that science tells us that it was created by unguided natural processes, that we don't find any evidence to suggest that there was some kind of deity that imbued this world with values. And so people are more and more coming to this conclusion that if we want values that we can live by, we have got to create them and stand by them ourselves. So that's one of the main reasons. The other, I think, is that people are mixing more and more. The world is becoming smaller and more diverse. And as we meet people from different religions, different backgrounds, and we learn that they're just as good as we are, they're just as good people as we are, it's natural for many of us to come to the conclusion that, well, maybe my religion wasn't the one true revealed religion of the world. Maybe human beings created religion and not vice versa.
Well, and of course, what you're saying is blasphemy to many people hearing it. Have you been attacked for it?
Absolutely. You know, and there is some prejudice out there. And part of us coming out and saying we're going to build a humanist community is to say, this can't go on. We are here. We're here to stay. We're 20% of the young people in this country. And all we want is to live good lives alongside you other Americans who may not happen to share this aspect of our views.
Well, this idea that you want to build a humanist community, have a place for humanists to go.
Mm-hmm.
As you all know, we've spoken of some of the criticism from outside of your thinking, but within the atheist community, there's been a lot of controversy because people say that what you're talking about sounds dangerously like building a religion, even if it's a religion that doesn't believe in God.
When it comes to practical matters, humanism is not a religion because most people in America associate that word in English, religion, with something that contains a deity or the supernatural, and humanism does not. However, on a sociological level, humanism is somewhat similar to a religion in that it contains a set of values, a way of looking at the world, a way of acting in the world, and it defines a particular set of people.
Well, what's it going to look like? How do you envision it? Because, you know, people have said, okay, you get together and maybe you'll have songs that you'll sing. Well, you'll have songs that you'll sing, and you call yourself a chaplain. And the next thing you know, it really is starting to feel like a church, and a lot of atheists are individualists. They say, I don't need a chaplain to lead me. I don't need to be told what song to sing.
Sure, and neither do I, quite frankly. We don't need religion in terms of that dogmatic telling us what to do. However, we know from our understanding of science, from our understanding of human nature, that human beings need community. We are social animals, and we cannot survive and live good lives alone.
Well, this criticism, of that thinking of organizing almost a church of humanism, as you said, comes from other atheists. And last spring, you called atheists who are anti-religious fundamentalists. Caused an uproar because that's a pejorative for them. They believe it applies to dogmatic religious fundamentalists to whom they assign a lot of the problems of the world.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that, calling other atheists who are anti-religious fundamentalists?
Well, that's a little bit of a misunderstanding because I don't believe that some of the prominent atheist authors out there are fundamentalists. That's not what I meant to say. However, I did mean to raise a point about the fact that a lot of the best-selling books that we've seen of late about atheism criticize what's bad about religion. But I don't think that they do enough of what I think is something that's even more important, which is to talk about what's good about humanism and how we can live good lives without God. And that's what humanism is all about. Atheism is what I don't believe in, but humanism is what I do believe in.
Well, Joseph Hoffman, a senior vice president at the Center for Inquiry, as you well know, an atheist group, has said that you promote Gen X humanism for the passionately confused. Is there any truth in that? That, you know, maybe you're gathering a flock of people who just don't quite know what they want, but it's more palatable than maybe the religion they grew up with, but it's still religion.
We do welcome people who are searching or seeking to be part of the community that we're building. This is not an exclusivist community where we say, if you're not a humanist just like us, get out. We're too intellectual for you. No. We are a warm and welcoming community, and we're very proud of that. And in fact, there are a lot of people who aren't quite sure where they fit on the religious spectrum. And what we want to do is provide something where those people and those of us who consider ourselves humanists, atheists, agnostics can come together and build something positive.
Is this evangelical?
I'm not an evangelical because I'm not out trying to convert people, and that's not my interest. However, that doesn't mean that I intend to be silent as a humanist, and that doesn't mean that I tend to back down from my beliefs. Humanism is about reaching out and saying to the world, here we are, there are a billion of us, and we want every person in the world to have heard of humanism. If you've ever heard of Christianity, if you've ever heard of Islam, our goal is that you'll have heard of humanism and you'll understand what it's all about.
And we'll have more with humanist chaplain Greg Epstein after a quick minute break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Greg Epstein. He grew up a secular Jew, was ordained as a humanist rabbi after studying in Jerusalem, and is now Harvard University's humanist chaplain. Greg, getting back to your idea of humanism becoming more organized, like, well, a religion, you have an event tonight. We're going to talk about that. But you held a new humanism conference this past spring. Salman Rushdie was one of the speakers, and he suggested there'd be something like atheismus, you know, Christmas for atheists. How would that be different from, paganism?
Well, first of all, there's nothing wrong and everything right with celebrating the meaningful times in our lives and the meaningful times throughout the year. To say that these ideas of let's celebrate the meaningful times of the year, something like the winter solstice or the summer solstice, to say that that came from religion is ridiculous. In fact, religion adopted the natural human tendency to celebrate life. And so we do have these kinds of celebrations, and I do humanist weddings, funerals, baby naming ceremonies, and that sort of thing all the time. In fact, I can't even fill all the requests that I have for doing such ceremonies. However, most atheist Christians celebrate Christmas. Most atheist Jews would celebrate Hanukkah. And so one of the things that humanism can do is it can take these holidays, Hanukkah, Christmas, Passover, Easter, whatever you have it, and we want to turn them into a more humanistic celebration. So we make that celebration no longer about giving praise to God, but we make it about celebrating our history, celebrating our culture, celebrating our values, celebrating each other.
Well, tonight you are hosting the annual Harvard Humanist of the Year lecture. Pete Stark of California, Congressman Pete Stark, will speak. I think the Globe sort of characterized it as sort of his coming out as an atheist.
Well, we're not going to have confetti, and I'm not sure about a cake, but you can call it a coming out party for him as a humanist. This is going to be the first time in American political history that a sitting congressman will give a speech about his values as a humanist and as a non-theist. And we're incredibly excited about that. Pete Stark is a hero.
Well, hero to you, and I'm sure you know that he will be attacked by many of his constituents, because it seems as if, well, you know, humanism, atheism may be coming to politics. It's rare. It seems as if it's going in the other direction in politics. In the last presidential election, we saw more and more candidates, especially from the Democratic Party, never comfortable with talking about their faith, talking about their faith often uncomfortably.
One of the reasons why politicians sometimes seem to be uncomfortable talking about their faith is because they may not even know how to say this, but their values in many cases are shaped by humanism. Barack Obama is a great example. Barack Obama talks in one of his memoirs about the fact that his mother was a secular humanist and his father most likely was an agnostic or an atheist as well.
A recent survey said Americans, largely by a huge majority, wouldn't vote for an atheist. They wouldn't vote for a Mormon either in this survey, but wouldn't vote for an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
Pete Stark, as heroic as he might be to you, isn't going to run for president.
It's going to take some time for this to be a little bit more mainstream, but I'm very hopeful because, in fact, the response to Pete Stark's decision to come out as a humanist and a non-theist has been extremely positive. Most people out there have never really felt that they've had an opportunity to come out and say, wait, that's me. I am a humanist. I'm part of something bigger than just myself.
How much do you think the growing number of atheists is also part of an observation of how religion is being used in different ways?
There are a number of people who've been wounded by religion, no question about it. There have been too many abuses, too many scandals, too many affronts to the truth in one or another religious group for people to not start questioning. That doesn't mean that I think that all religions have these problems, and I think that there are plenty of great religious communities and good religious people out there, but the fact is that these scandals and these controversies are real, and people do start questioning them, and if those people want to become atheists, agnostics, and especially humanists, we're here to welcome them.
I'm sure you've had friends, you know, late at night quietly ask you, are you sure? I mean, do you ever have moments of doubt where, someone you love is ill, some moment that's scary for you on an airplane where you don't find yourself saying, I mean, you were, born a Jew, that you don't find yourself saying, God, help me, or, moments where you think, am I out of my mind? That's really stacking the cards, No doubt?
Hmm.
No doubt in your doubt.
First of all, about the issue of doubt, the whole idea of humanism is that if we do see any reliable evidence for a supreme and all-powerful, all-good deity, we'll change our minds. But for the time being, we can be very confident that there is no evidence and that we don't believe that there will be any evidence. However, the other issue is really important, and that's something that I think doesn't get addressed enough, which is that it is really difficult to be a human being. Life can be so lonely at times. Life can be so scary at times. And we never know when we're going to get injured, when we're going to get sick, when we're going to have some kind of tragedy, have our hearts broken. And humanism really does have a very powerful message for people in all of those situations. And the message is, my strength and my hope, the strength and the hope that I need to live a good and decent life are inside of me. And they're also in you. And I need to draw on my own strength and on yours. And you need to draw on your own strength and on mine. That we don't get our strength from a supernatural deity. And we don't get it at the expense of other people. We get it from other people and from each other. And that's enough. And once I think that we understand that message, it can be incredibly liberating to feel that, we don't need to look for something that we can't see and we can't feel and we can't touch to have a good lives, that we do have enough right here in this world.
No doubt. Not on a roller coaster that you think isn't going to...
First of all, doubt is something that we encourage. Doubt everything. Be a skeptic is part of the humanist ethos.
Even skeptical of your own disbelief in God.
Well, we need to constantly challenge ourselves. However, the evidence is very strong. And the evidence is in. And it says that human beings are here on this earth as part of a natural process, an unguided natural process that's gone on for billions of years. And now it's up to us to figure out what to do about that.
It's been fascinating, Greg. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Robin.
Greg Epstein, humanist chaplain at Harvard University. To learn more about their event tonight, go to our website, here-now.org. Now I have to move away from you because that lightning rod's going to hit. No, just kidding. And tomorrow on Here and Now, a former NPR and New York Times reporter on what it was like growing up with parents on the run from their own demons and the FBI. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, a wide-ranging White House press conference after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush answered questions about Iraq, Iran, race relations, the economy, and the presidential race during a wide-ranging White House news conference today. Before taking questions, the president made a statement challenging Democrats on their proposal for a $35 billion increase in a children's health insurance program, the S-CHIP program, which expires at the end of the month.
Democratic leaders in Congress want to put more power in the hands of government by expanding federal health care programs. Their S-CHIP plan is an incremental step toward the goal of government-run health care for every American.
The president urged lawmakers to send him a simple extension of the program if both sides can't agree on terms of a new measure. Well, Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, was listening in. He joins us now. Richard, a lot of ground covered. We want to cover as much as we can, but I want to stay with the S-CHIP, the Children's Insurance Plan. Recently, a young child died in Washington, D.C. because of a lack of dental care. And we understand he had become the face of this push for getting more money, more coverage for kids. Yet the president didn't seem to waver in the face of that story.
No, well, this is election season, of course, and all Democratic candidates are out there talking about how to move towards universal health care. So there's a political side to this. There's also, remember, Alan Greenspan's recent criticism of the president about spending. So you have two factors going on here. He wants to spend $5 billion. The Democrats want to spend $35 billion. There's a big gap there. And when you factor in election politics, you end up with the president saying no.
Well, I want to talk to you about former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan, who has a new memoir out, who was harshly critical of the Republicans and others, but specifically we're speaking of the Republicans in the book. Greenspan then has been criticized for not saying those things at the time that he was serving. But was the president asked about Greenspan's criticism of, the Republican, as Greenspan put it, spending of money for political gain?
Yes, he was asked about it. In fact, he was asked about that and criticism from Donald Rumsfeld, the recently departed defense secretary. And, you know, it was interesting comparing the reactions of the president to both of those, because he had a good joke about Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld said, was asked, did he miss President Bush? And he told a recent magazine interview, no. And the president had a good chuckle about that. But when it came to Alan Greenspan, he's... smile looked much more forced, and he hit back pretty strongly. He said that he thought he'd done a pretty good job of restraining spending and keeping the economy moving. So there's a recognition there, I think, just on the president's face, that the Greenspan's comments, his criticisms, really hit home there, and the president needed to push back.
Which perhaps, as you said, might also dovetail with his firmness about not raising the spending in the children's health insurance program. One last thing about Alan Greenspan's comments. He also said in different places, I heard it on the Today Show, that the Iraq War was all about oil. Yeah. That, in fact, he had gone and said that you have to invade Iraq because otherwise it's going to destabilize the oil flow. He said, of course it was about oil. Was the president asked about that?
Not specifically about that comment. Greenspan has tried to put that comment into some context, and it's not surprising, I suppose, that he would look at an economic point of view about the Iraq War. But the administration, the White House, continues to say that this was a national security issue. It wasn't about oil. And, you know, there is obviously a clear political difference between the president's critics and what the White House still maintains about this war.
Okay, we might as well just stay with the economy, but a different topic within that file. The president sought to assure jittery Americans today that the economy basically is in good shape despite worries about a recession, the credit crunch, the housing crisis. Let's listen.
There is no question that there is some unsettling times in the housing market and credits associated with the housing market. And that's why I look forward to working with Congress to modernize the FHA loans so that people can refinance their homes, and to change the tax code so that if somebody renegotiates a loan, they don't have to pay a penalty, a tax penalty, in so doing. I'm optimistic about our economy. I would be pessimistic, however, if the Congress has its way and raises taxes.
Richard Wolff, was the president asked about tougher regulations for lenders?
Not specifically. It was more about the question of whether the economy is on the brink of recession. And he says that growth is still pretty good. But he was a lot less confident when it came to job creation. The recent job numbers really put the markets in a tailspin, and they were actually very weak. So he was a lot less confident and optimistic about that. But you just heard that little political flip he did, pushing it back on Democrats about tax cuts. That's a cheap political trick, I'm afraid, but doesn't get to the heart of the question about the economic outlook for this country and what a lot of economists think is a fairly weak one.
Okay, to the topic of Iraq. Yesterday, the Webb Amendment, an attempt to make law that troops come home after a certain amount of time, it failed. First of all, what's the significance of that? Is it seen as, some are seeing it as, you know, the fact that this is it for Democrats impacting war policy?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. It means the momentum has stopped and even reversed a little, and that's a problem for Democrats, both politically, strategically, but also with their own base. We're going to see Democrats trying and having a number of different votes, but really, you know, even just a week or two ago, Democrats were saying maybe we can peel off a few more Republicans and take a more moderated position on this, find common ground. All of that talk has died, and the administration, the White House, is looking pretty confident now that they can really hang on to the end of their term.
On the subject of Iraq, President Bush said there was progress in local communities in Iraq. People are dissatisfied with the central government. You know, he referenced that he'd been asked, you know, how come there isn't somebody who's emerging, you know, sort of an Iraqi Nelson Mandela to bring instant democracy? Let's listen to his response.
You know, part of the reason why there's not this kind of instant democracy in Iraq is because people are still recovering from Saddam Hussein's brutal rule. I thought an interesting comment was made when somebody said to me, I heard somebody say, you know, where's Mandela? Well, Mandela's dead because Saddam Hussein killed all the Mandelas. He was a brutal tyrant that divided people up and split families, and people are recovering from this. So there's a psychological recovery that is taking place.
Richard Wolff, you hear the president speak quite often. We just have a few seconds left, but was he sounding particularly Texan today? Was there something different in his voice that you heard, or are we just hearing that?
Well, I have to admit there were a lot of startled looks when he declared Nelson Mandela to be dead. But we kind of got what he...
Metaphorically. Yeah.
It took us a while to understand it was just an image. He compresses other people's arguments, and he was doing it very forcefully today. No one's talking about instant democracy. 3 or 4 years would be plenty of time.
Richard Wolff, Newsweek magazine, on today's wide-ranging White House press conference. Richard, thanks as always.
Anytime.
And before we go today, the small but passionate number of Jews in Cuba. That's still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, like many subdivisions, the Bend, Oregon neighborhood of Aubrey Butte has rules. They're called covenants, conditions, and restrictions on what you can do with your property. You must promise to paint your house only in the approved medium to dark color tones. You must pledge to only use approved play sets for your kids. And you must keep your backyard free of unsightly obstructions like clotheslines. Well, joining us now, Susan Taylor, a 55-year-old mom, a part-time nurse, and apparently a renegade because she lives in Aubrey Butte and she decided to air her laundry in public. Susan, you knew the rules, no clothesline, so why'd you do it?
I was listening, actually, to an NPR station, and there was a lawyer who was giving this talk about our environment and the very narrow window that we have to respond to global warming and decreasing our greenhouse emissions. At that point, I just said, that's it. I'm hanging a laundry line out.
We hear that it costs about $80 a year to use a dryer, so there's potentially that savings. Your neighbors called. You've had a series of letters from Brooks Resources, which manages the subdivision. They warned that they might sue you and also asked you to put up a screen to hide your clothing. Now, you put a screen up. What did that look like?
Well, that was my first attempt at trying to screen my clothes, and it came out a little tie-dyed looking, but it was an earth tone.
They said the screen didn't blend with your home or the surrounding community, so
right,
that didn't
right.
work. Well, they also told you that if you can get 51% of your neighbors to sign a petition, they might consider changing the rules. How are you doing with that?
You know, I haven't pursued that at all. Most of the people that live up here, I don't think there's much of a care or concern, and getting 51%, I think, is just not feasible.
Well, because of you, we now know that there are things like clothesline advocacy groups. There's one in Concord, New Hampshire called the Project Laundry List. Well, they say they get requests all the time of, you know, people seeking advice on how to hang a clothesline despite neighborhood covenants. Have they advised you?
They have not, but I just have to tell you, I mean, thank goodness for Project Laundry List and Alexander Lee. We are so scattered across the United States, and there's people that are hiding their clothes because of these same rules and restrictions.
I understand you are hiding your clothing now in the garage?
That's where my clotheslines are hanging now, yes, and that was not acceptable to have the garage door open because the clotheslines are still visible to one of my complaining neighbors.
To some people, you know, who string their clothes out on a clothesline every day in order to save energy or to get the fresh smell or the sun or, you know, whatever, this sounds a little, it sounds kind of wacky. But on the other hand, we always hear from people when we discuss these subdivision requirements because they say, look, it's about our property values. It's about what I want to see when I look out my back door. Do you have any sympathy for that?
Absolutely none. It is beyond my comprehension when there is such a much bigger issue than the subjective aesthetic views of what my clothes look like hanging on a line. We need to look at things differently.
Well, we understand at least one of your neighbors, John McLaughlin, says he may put up his own line. He agrees with what is being called clothesline values.
Yes.
And so he may do that, but if you don't get that kind of support, you know, sort of a movement, what are you going to do?
My ultimate goal would be to get legislation passed that will override these ridiculous rules that don't reflect today's need.
Well, meantime, if the neighborhood organization does file legal action, will you move?
We are already looking at different property because I just have a difficult time with that whole value system and neighbors that think it's more important to not look at laundry lines than it is to save our planet.
Susan Taylor in Bend, Oregon, in the Aubrey Butte subdivision, where she's putting up a clothesline to help fight global warming and is now facing legal action from the builders of the division. Susan, thanks for telling us your story.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, we want to let you weigh in on this or any story. You must have some thoughts on this. I'm thinking some people can't afford a dryer. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Of course, there are other people who say, it's my property values. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Coming up, growing up Jewish in Castro's Cuba. After a quick break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
You tickle me, I tickle you, I tickle you, you tickle me. We kittle talking now.
That's Mickey Katz singing with Cuban musician and band leader Xavier Cugat. It's a relic from Cuba's pre-revolutionary past when a vibrant community of about 15,000 Jews lived on the Caribbean island. Today there are about 1,200, mostly in Havana. There is no rabbi living there. There's only one kosher butcher. Intermarriage is common. As Cuban historian Maritza Corrales writes, to be Cuban and Jewish is to be twice survivors. More than 90% of Cuba's Jews left and became self-described Jubans in Miami and other cities after Castro came to power in 1959. He quickly nationalized private business and religious practice went underground. Remaining Jews struggle to keep their traditions alive in rituals that have been documented by photographer Linda Hirsch. She was captivated by fledgling Jewish communities when she traveled to Cuba to deliver Hebrew literature and medicine with Temple Beth El from Sudbury, Massachusetts, 6 years ago. Now she carries cameras and teaches people there to tell their own stories in words and pictures. You can take a look at some of her photographs at our website, here-now.org, while we welcome Linda. Welcome.
Hi.
We understand that you say, you know, some Seder's Jews will say next year in Israel. In many parts of Cuba, I understand they say next year in Miami.
Well, yes. But actually, it's becoming more next year in Yerushalayim because more of them are leaving for Israel now.
For Israel.
Yes.
Tell us, because we think of Cuba as a place where there isn't a lot of religious freedom. So how have they been practicing? I mean, you visited one community that had maybe, 24 Jews. So mm-hmm. do they have temples?
Well, since 1993, there's been a revival, a renewal of interest and a revival. This followed the exit of the Russians. Religious observance is allowed. Judaism is, I wouldn't say thriving, but is allowed. And there are about a dozen communities scattered around the island, three major shuls, congregations in Havana itself. And then scattered around the country, there are either small temples or just people meeting in homes, such as in Cienfuego, where I landed first and formed the initial bond. People meet in a home. It has become a sanctuary, but there is no Torah scroll, no raised podium for ritual. It's a living room.
Well, and when you say that it's sort of come out in the open, you attended the centennial celebration of organized Jewish presence in Cuba.
Yes.
That was in 2006. And it's very difficult to make recordings in Cuba, but we have a snippet from one you made at that celebration. Let's mm-hmm. listen to this, you know, mingling of cultures. There's music from Fiddler on the Roof at that celebration. Let's listen. There was also some traditional music performed. We want to hear that as well. What's that like? I mean, here you are, an American. They're Cuban. But you share the language of Hebrew, so mm-hmm. I'm wondering what was that moment like?
It felt very natural. I actually was thinking a lot about that coming here today. The people there whom I've worked with who are Jewish and Cuban, they see themselves as Jewish and then Cuban, because that's our initial bond, is mm-hmm. through the Judaism. And the others who aren't Jewish, we bond as just fellow human beings. They're Cubano, I'm Americano, but we're able to communicate on many levels. Their literacy enables them to understand and access a lot. They're just not privy to a lot of information. Mm. I brought a book of poetry, Octavio Paz, with me, and I fell ill on my last trip and was very well cared for. I sat in the Casa Particular, private home, and spoke with the owner. I read in Spanish to practice the poetry of Octavio Paz, and he read back to me in English, and then we conversed about the content. I have goosebumps. These are wonderful people.
I also understand that you brought them, speaking of readings and writings, mm-hmm. Anne Frank.
Yes. I also brought a DVD in Spanish, and we sat and watched it together. And my translator, who was not Jewish, completely dissolved. She didn't know much about the Holocaust.
Really?
She had never seen anything of this nature and asked afterwards, how can people do this to one another?
And she was not Jewish.
She was not Jewish and had never been taught or heard about this. The Jewish community there was somewhat conversant, but still hadn't seen the graphic material. And when I say that, again, goosebumps. And during the centennial, they did perform the Diary of Anne Frank. Huh. So,
how else did they relate to that story? Do they see themselves as people who are sort of underground for a while in Cuba and are now held in Cuba? Would they rather be in Israel? Would they rather be?
That's complex. I think primarily they see themselves as isolated, not persecuted. There was discrimination earlier, but they feel connected through projects such as this, and the teenagers all get to make through Canada a birthright trip to Israel. It's called Taglit. So every Jewish teenager, those deemed Jewish with a Jewish parent or whom have who have converted or become Bar Bat Mitzvah, they all get to go to Israel. And I'm hoping to be able to document that aspect of this and make that connection a richer one.
Yeah.
The kids come back, they go to university, they serve in the military, and then many of them have increasingly been making Aliyah.
Going back to Israel. For good.
The dilemma is, for those who are young, who have been trained and educated, there are not enough jobs. And so, of course, they're not going to sit around and wait. They're leaving. They want to come back. They will come back when things change and when the U.S. drops the embargo.
And we remind ourselves Cuba and Israel don't have relations.
They do in strange ways. This is another complexity. Fidel and the Palestinians have a bond. There is this complex little dance that Israel isn't officially recognized, but here people are coming and going. Technology is shipped from Israel all the time, computers, etc. And there's definitely trade with Israel, and it's beneficial. They dance both ways, and with the U.S. government as well. There's trade with the U.S. It's not broadcast, but it's definitely going on. So it's a strange little paradox.
You documented another ceremony in Cuba. Was it a bar mitzvah in Cienfuegos?
In 2004, there were b'nai mitzvah. That's a double bar mitzvah, two people. That was celebrated in Havana because there is, again, no synagogue in Cienfuegos. Those were the first b'nai mitzvah in a very long time. They were historic. And the boys acquitted themselves beautifully, and I recorded that. And then in 2006, when I returned for the centennial, there was a bat and a bar mitzvah which occurred.
And what a beautiful boy.
Yes, he is.
What's he carrying in your picture?
Torah scroll, which is the scriptures, the holy words. And they chant in transliterated Hebrew. It's a very funny, it's like dancing the salsa when you're praying. It's wonderful.
I'm not going to ask why this is important to you. Anyone would want to help their faith. But what if the Jews all leave? What is the importance then?
Within the next decade, I see a sea change, a literal sea change. I think there will be a return back to their homeland.
Homeland of Cuba.
Yes. Yeah. It has always been the gateway of Judaism in the Caribbean. And so even if it were to be that no Jews were left, you have the cemeteries to prove they were there. You have the Holocaust memorials to say they're connected to every other Jew who ever lived and died. And you have their stories in pictures they will be taking with cameras I'm bringing there. That's why this is so powerful and important. To document means to say we were here. We played a part in world Judaism.
Photographer Linda Hirsch documenting the lives of Jews in Cuba. To see her pictures and get more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Linda, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.